Shubhadeep Mukhopadhyay ji and Manojna Shastri ji to present on Audrey Trushke.
So Audrey Trushke is a well-known public intellectual, academic and social media activist. She is a professor at Rutgers University, a member of American Institute of Pakistan Studies. She's a key driver of the Hindutva Harassment Field Manual, which is ostensibly meant to protect people from attacks against Hindutva. She has received numerous accolades and grants for her contribution to South Asian cultural and intellectual history. At the same time, there are allegations that through her scholarship, as well as activism, she perpetuates blatant Hindophobia. Trushke, however, dismisses such allegations. She labels all her detractors as trolls or Hindutvavadis. That is the term she uses. And she has often claimed that she has been targeted by Hindus for belonging to the wrong color and the wrong sex. So in our essay, what we do is we analyze in depth some of her key positions on Mughal history, Aurangzeb especially, Hinduism, Hindutva, and modern India. So during our study, what became clear is that she is very uncomfortable with the idea of a strong Indian state, a theme that we have seen earlier also in the other heads that were discussed. And she's also uncomfortable with the idea of dharma in India. So in this specific presentation, I'll just cover two of her key academic positions. So just a quick look at what is revisionism. So revisionism, it has its root in Marxist thought. So this is basically you're looking at existing conclusions and adding newer sources, newer evidences to try to get a better understanding of the past. It often leads to reinterpretation of historical accounts and challenges established views, mainstream narratives, as well as popular misconceptions. It has had its good uses also because it has helped in providing a better understanding of indigenous people in former colonies like America and Australia. So while revisionism is a good thing, when it is taken to extreme, driven by either by ideology or some kind of an agenda, it leads to what is called negationism. So people are made to doubt sources. And some people, they deliberately mistranslate text and derive questionable conclusions. An example of with something all Indians can relate to is swastiks, which is associated with Nazism. So the word Hakenkreuz in German was translated as swastika very mischievously, and this has taken a life of its own. Examples of full-scale negationism, for example, Armenian genocide, the genocide of Native Americans, Jewish Holocaust. So these were actually denied for a very long time. Some still are. And there's a lot of literature which I've given a few references. People could read that. In an Indian context, there have been attempts to present a particular narrative which downplays much of the violence and persecution faced by people in the last millennia. So Trushke, this is where she comes in. She has actually carried forward this tradition of negationism, which we have tried to show with evidence. So she propagates an alternate history of India, where the persecutors, the religious persecutors, are shown as blameless and often benevolent, while the victims are blamed for all the ills which are facing Indian society today. So what are some of her key positions which we have covered in our essay? So she claims that the claims of temple destructions and iconoclasm have been vastly exaggerated, and mostly by proponents of Hindutva, that it's all a figment of Hindutva imagination, that even if something did happen, like an odd temple raising or two, the motivation behind it was not religious per se, but driven by real politic. And so this is the best one. And that the Islamic invaders, they picked up the practice of temple destruction from Hindu kings themselves. This is one of her key positions. So I will cite all the evidence at a later slide. She says that Aurangzeb perhaps destroyed maybe a handful of temples, and that the evidence is quite thin, that it was part of the British divide and rule policy. And that is how this whole thing came about of Islamic invaders destroying temples. Now, there's this book called Ma'asir-e-Alamgiri. It's an important source which is about the life and times of Aurangzeb, and it very squarely contradicts her claims. It was written 3 years after Aurangzeb died by Saki Mustaid Khan, and the Inayatullah Khan Kashmiri, who was Aurangzeb's secretary, so he made the entire records and archives available to the author, Saki Mustaid Khan. And this work actually details a lot of imperial orders, a lot of records of temples which were destroyed during Aurangzeb's reign. So I'll just give you one specific example to show that this earlier claim that a few dozen temples, how that is wrong from this text. So this is in 1680. So you can look at the details. So what this means is, if you add up all the numbers, that these instances are very specific, very detailed. The information is unambiguous, and there is nothing fragmentary or incomplete about the evidence which I had cited earlier. I mean, these are taken from that book. It's an old Persian text from Aurangzeb's time, and in 2 months, 238 temples were destroyed. So this is far greater than the so-called few dozen temples which she claims in her in 4 decades. So why does she do that, and how does she actually explain this inconsistency? Because this is one book that nobody can actually, she's used it herself, as I'll show in a later case. So what she does is, she denies the credibility of this entire book. So she says that the author Khan has a habit of exaggerating, and but why she thinks so, she does not tell us that. The fact that the author had access to the royal archives and state archives, yet we are asked to believe that he made up all these very specific dates. Like, if I'll just go back to the slide once again, you can quickly see he's given the exact date on which day, how many temples at which place. So we are asked to believe by Trushke that all these are figment of this author's imagination. Now, if we refer to the work of Jadunath Sarkar, he had very pointed out very early on that while it is true that many of these works have effusive praise for their rulers, in terms of facts, they are quite accurate. We cannot deny the factual matter of these texts, although we may be dismissive of the language used and the kind of effusive praise given. But while she dismisses this book on one hand, from the same book, she picks up one specific example to buttress her case that temple destruction was actually a very rare thing. I've cited that example. So on the one hand, she's dismissing the book when it comes to temple destruction. But same book she's using to use her claim that no, temple destruction was actually very rare. So this is an instance probably of cherry picking evidence to suit her specific narrative. The second point that she talks about is iconoclasm, which is basically religiously sanctioned murti destruction or idol destruction. So her thesis is that temples were essentially political structures. That is the thesis. And hence, when temples were destroyed, they were politically motivated destructions. In fact, it was the Hindu kings themselves who looted and defiled images of Hindu deities. That is the thesis. They destroyed each other's temples routinely and even commissioned poetry to celebrate such destructions. In fact, she takes this actually forward, this thesis forward, and says that when Muslim invaders came to India for the first time, that is how they picked up this practice of destruction of temples and raising the idols. So what she writes is, so Aurangzeb followed suit in considering Hindu temples legitimate targets of punitive state action. So she's moved everything from the religious domain to a matter of polity or state politics. So now now that that has been taken care of, so we have to come to the part about Brahmins, because without Brahmin, a little bit of Brahmin bashing, this entire analysis is not complete. So she now blames Brahmins themselves for being responsible for temple destruction. So how? The logic is that the greedy Brahmins, I mean, you can see the quotes in the chapter I've shared, they were teaching false texts, you know, false books in the temples. And Aurangzeb actually felt very sad that the greedy Brahmins were misleading the other Hindus, the so-called lower castes. And out of compassion, he destroyed the temples associated with those Brahmins. That is her thesis. There's actually no evidence for these things, but that is what she claims. So, like I said, Hindu iconoclasm, it's an oxymoron. So yes, there were a few instances of Hindu kings taking away deities. It has happened before, but they were not destroyed. They were consecrated with great pomp and ceremony in the other kingdom. So it was precise opposite of idol smashing. On the other hand, the iconoclasm that we see during the invasion of whether it's India or other parts of the Middle East, they were actually driven by religious reasons completely. An example is if you know this iconic image, Bamiyan Buddha, before and after. This has happened within our lifetime. So there's absolutely no evidence that it was the Hindu kings who taught Muslims how to destroy murtis. These are based on various studies. I've cited the sources that a very systematic study of numerous texts have not shown such an evidence. In fact, many of the Islamic chronicles, in whether it's mostly in Persian, they're extremely proud that they're following the religious tenets while destroying temples.
So on the Ayodhya judgment, Trishri has in fact authored an article post the judgment on the Ram Janmabhoomi case, showing very little understanding of either the Indian judiciary or even the entire matter at hand. She has cast aspersions on the judges of India's Supreme Court and has said that the judgment copy is devoid of any history before the 19th century. In fact, she says that, it's amazing that she has, she claims to be a Sanskritist and has a background in Hinduism, while she says that Sri Rama is not even a historical figure to begin with. And thus the onus now lies on the Hindus to first prove his historical existence. What Trishre seems to not have read in the 900 odd pages of the judgment are various sections considering the verses from sources such as the Skanda Purana, Ayodhya Mahatmya, and so on, which build on the association of the place under dispute in Ayodhya with the birth of Sri Rama. Trishre's scholarship in pre-modernity is further called into doubt, while she makes her scorn for Hinduism and its practitioners obvious when she remarks that most Hindus did not much care about Ram's birthplace, an apathy indicated by the sheer lack of attention to this issue in pre-modern texts. Trishre's analysis in the article is in fact at times so infantile that she is actually counting the number of times the word Hindus is mentioned in the Supreme Court judgment and says it's been mentioned 299 times, while the Muslims is spoken relatively lesser, that is 174 times, and hence, you know, the judgment is partial towards the Hindus. So while, of course, such silly barometers, which are supposed to constitute judicial fairness, is shocking, it becomes further clear that Trishre's issue is not whether the Supreme Court, you know, has defined Hindus or Muslims or whatever it is. But I think the issue comes from recognition that a group of biased, motivated distortionists such as herself increasingly no longer find currency today, right? So that is why in the judgment copy, when you have the unearthing of all the pillars which were previously there in the existing temple, the previous temple, all of these which are there, when they have been pointed out, Trishre instead accuses the Hindus of using sophistry in terms of presenting evidence for their case, So the evidence is not being considered on its own merit, but instead the Hindus are being accused of sophistry for presenting that evidence. Further, she seems to be rehashing notions from colonial scholarship, where she perpetuates the idea of the Ramayana being an imaginary work. And thus, by modern legal standards, the Hindu claimants have no compelling evidence regarding Ram's life and birthplace. Another section that we have considered in the paper is Trushke and her episodes of mistranslations. One particularly stands out. So Audrey Trushke has a long record of translating words from Sanskritam to present a colorful tone of passages from key Hindu texts. And in some case, even manufacturing what she wants to read into a text. Despite her claimed expertise in Sanskrit, the numerous examples of Trushke's translations call into question not only her ability, but demonstrate a prejudiced gaze. Consider, for instance, the 2018 episode where Trushke, when she was translating passages from the Ramayana to attribute to Devi Sita, lines which were a complete fabrication and not even present in the original Valmiki text. Referring to supposed lines 6.102 to 106, Trushke claims to use the Sanskritist Robert Goldman's translation and says, Devi Sita loosely, I quote, loosely called Bhagwan Rama a, I quote, a misogynist pig and uncouth, I end quotes. So when challenged by many to produce the exact lines in the Valmiki Ramayana from the text to back up her claims, Trushke said that she has been using Goldman's translation. When a concerned reader, in fact, Mr. Venkat Vaikuntha Narayanan, reached out to the Sanskritist Robert Goldman himself with Trushke's claims, Goldman wrote back, clearly refuting any such interpretation of the text in his work. In fact, he said, what Trushke has done was translate the text in ways that suited her agenda and attributed it to the authority of Goldman's work for credibility. Goldman's quote is on the slide, exactly what he said. He says he found it extremely disturbing, but perhaps not unexpected. Despite Dr. Goldman's clear rebuttal, Trushke neither withdrew her statements nor issued any correction. In fact, even Nityananda Mishraji, who is another Sanskritist, has also provided a detailed analysis of this episode. And Trushke's tweets on this matter remain on her account to this day. What Trushke did instead of issuing a withdrawal or a correction was portraying herself as a victim in this entire episode. And she's the victim, apparently, from the hatred and abuse which supposedly Hindus shared on her by pointing out the truth. So she's written in the wire that she did not, without addressing specifically the origin of her translations, instead she comes across as somehow being proud of the controversy, and shockingly, and one even wonders at her delusions, when she tries to compare the situation to the original in the text, and she being in a place similar to Devi Sita. Trushke has in fact frequently resorted to victimhood, and this has become a rather predictable part of her modus operandi, which also calls into question if it is all a part of her strategy to garner more reportage and eyeballs. So in our paper, apart from these two and what Shubhadeep has presented, we have cited all the evidences, and in the paucity of time, we refer you to the original. Thank you.
Thank you, Shubhadeep and Manogna. I kindly request author Abbas Maldahia to comment.
A very good evening to all of you. I'm glad that I've been invited to speak on one of the topic of the book, of which all the 10 of them are necessarily very important and certainly cater to an aspect which we all, young Indians, and also those who have progressed and read all the works of all these scholars in the past, considering them to be something of scholarly nature, need to look at. Now, given my background, I do come with a background of architectural education and urban design. Plainly speaking, someone may find that what an architect or a person of architecture has got to do with history. But I always do say, whenever I'm in a public gathering or somewhere, when I'm given to speak around history, I do say that perhaps architects and historians ka jan jan mantar ka rishta hai, because what we will build as architects today will become the subject for the historians in the future. So it goes on and on. So what was done in the past by architects is being read by us. So somehow that always had brought my interest into the subject. But in the era of social media, I was certainly very alien to social media, and I came into it only in 2017, where my first encounter with Audrey Truscott happened. And just like a very naive guy, I always thought that, oh, fine, it's social media. So it's a place where you can interact, you can discuss with the people. And of course, given that they're scholars and whatnot, they will revert back, or maybe there will be some course of discussion or debate around something. So the first instance was the debate around Hinduism and Hindutva. It was back in 2017, October. She wrote a detailed thread explaining that how Hinduism is different from Hindutva, and that narrative is somewhat very much perpetrated into all of her literature. When you, right now, I was also going through the chapter on the Audrey Truscott, and I found that the authors or editors have certainly gone into detail to explain that how her agenda about vilifying Hindutva is a prime focus. Now, she made a case that Hindutva was an idea which emerged when the fascism and the Nazism were brewing up. And that somehow led Savarkar and the other nationalists to come up with the idea of Hindutva. Now, she also built a case that Hinduism is something which, as a term, were coined, certainly it's a fact that it was coined in 1830s through an affidavit. So perhaps there was no such thing called Hinduism which was existing before, as if there was nothing called water, so we were not drinking water. Certainly Hinduism was existing. And Hindutva certainly didn't emerge in 1920s as she was claiming to be, because the idea of Hindutva, or like how many people may like to look at it as Hindu nationalism, doesn't goes back only to Chhatrapati Shivaji Maharaj in form of Hindavi Swaraj, but it goes back to the establishment of Vijayanagar Empire, because it was formed as a strong opposition to the Muslim supremacy. And that is how the empire got into being. And the legacy was continued by the Marathas, and so on and on. Era was the 1920s. But before that, mind you, most of these people, including Dr. Tharoor, including Audrey Truscott, and many of them, do say that Hindutva as a term was introduced for the first time in the booklet written by Veer Savarkar, but that's not true. That's very far from truth. Because it was for the first time spoken in 1892 by Chandranath Basu. But his idea of Hindutva was very much different than what Savarkar was trying to convey for. Savarkar's idea of Hindutva was more about opposing the political Islam which was emerging. The era was 1920s, where Hindus were betrayed at the hand of the Khilafat movement. A lot was happening. Indian Muslims were mobilized to fight for a caliphate, which even the Muslims of Turkey were not looking to safeguard. So they were completely mobilized. The Mopla genocide had happened, and a lot were happening. Savarkar was back there in the cellular jail. And the incidences what he saw made him to come up with the idea that there has to be a notion of Hindu nationalism per se, or Hindutva. And he defined it very, that booklet of Hindutva is very profound, and it goes very well in nature. Now, Audrey Truscott goes on to blame Hindutva for it being kind of, it's a very racial in nature. It is casteist. But again, when you start looking into the facts of Hindutva, many traditionalists or the people who espouse for the traditional ethos of the Hinduism may not like what really comes out of the mouth of Savarkar, because he says that Varnashram needs to be disbanded. It needs to be demolished completely. So how they are perceiving the Hindutva to be, including Audrey Truscott, is certainly not whom she is saying to be the founder of Hindutva, that is, say, Veer Savarkar, wrongly even thought of so. Now, I did take care to define the whole thing in a matter of thread, a longish thread. I do have this habit of writing long threads on Twitter, which goes on to 100 tweets at times, and it will be a long chain of tweets. I did that. I went into the explanation in terms of the linguistic event that Hindutva is Hindu plus Tva. Hinduism is Hindu plus ism. Now, what does Tva stands for? Tva is something, it necessarily defines you to be in a state of something to which it's added. Like if you add Tva to Nari, it's Naritva. It means that you are in a state of being a Nari. Likewise, when I say Hindutva, it necessarily means I'm in a state of being Hindu. So perhaps in a time when Sri Ram is pleading for something, it is also a Hindu nature. But the moment he is angry with Samudra and he picks up the bow and arrow to do what he do, that also is Hindutva. So necessarily, Hindutva cannot be categorized into being pacifist or someone aggressive. It's just a very basic nature of a Hindu. That is Hindutva. Now, when it comes to the idea of Hinduism, Hindu plus ism, it certainly was added, as Trotsky says, that in the 19th century, it's 1830s, the affidavit came to and brought the word called Hinduism. But ism was always used as a term for a movement, what West saw as a derogatory idea back then. That's where ism stood for. Later on, when a lot of art movements arose, we got modernism, we got deconstructivism. There were many more ideas. Now, what is very interesting in this idea of ism, they all cater to a singular idea. Deconstructism can't merge with modernism. While when you say Hindutva plus Tva, it talks more about the diversity. So necessarily Hinduism, though people may not like it, but what the Britishers brought in as place was more of an oxymoron. But yes, idea of Sanatana Dharma was existing from quite long. Now, other point which, what Audrey always emphasizes upon is that, and I came across it very recently, only 2 years back. It was more that the idea that Hindus also demolished a lot of structure of Buddhists. And she wrote a very interesting paper about it. That paper is around 45 pages or something. I read it. I tried to understand her whole thesis about it, that what's wrong there. Now, I saw that she's linking back to the work of D.N. Jha. Then it happens, like you start scratching and you will find, and there's a lot of deposits of a lot of corruption which has happened in the past. Now, we heard a lot about Romila Thapar, but we have to give credit to Romila Thapar, but that she now disagrees that Pushyamitra Sangha would have demolished so many stupas, like the kind of allegation which are made against Pushyamitra Sangha. But Audrey Trotsky somehow doesn't agree to it. She also builds a case that Nalanda was not destroyed by Bhaktiyar Khilji. Now, how does she do it? While I was going through your chapter, you have posed a question that she's saying that the narratives given by the Islamic chroniclers are not something which you can trust upon. They can be exaggeration. Actually, in this paper, you have put the question, but in this very paper which I'm talking about, here she has answered that why you can't trust them. She says that Islamic chroniclers generally have this tendency to exaggerate. Now, if you pick this strand, then unfortunately, the whole history of Islam will get debased, because the first time, the first narrative of the biography of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, was written around 200 years after he died. That's in 632, he's supposed to have died. But the first biography appears around 800 something, the work of Ibn Hisham, which exists in the form of a hard copy with us. Now, the first hadiths do appear again all around in 9th century. Now, we are made to believe that Bin Qasim, actually I had the discussion about this with Dr. Els recently during Earth Literature Festival. So, Bin Qasim is said to have arrived in 712 AD. But the first text to talk about the Battle of Sindh, not Bin Qasim yet, appears in 892 AD. It means after 180 years. So who would have been hero of that civilization? You will not talk about him for 180 years. It is not possible, because the world is knowing how to write, how to read. Then, for the first time, Bin Qasim is elaborated more detail in Chachanama, which appears to be a text of 13th century, the 500 years gap. So yes, Islamic chroniclers have been exaggerating, but if you take that stand, then the whole history of Islam will start to get debased. Now, other point what she says, that while this text that supports the case of Bakhtiar Khilji having demolished the Nalanda, it is written by Minhaj is the name of the person who wrote the text. He writes this text after listening to a narrative given by a man, given by two people, two brothers rather, in Fargana. Those people were actually with Bakhtiar Khilji while this all was happening. She says that because it's a second-hand account, because the guys who were the part of the campaign have told the narrative, so it can't be trusted. Now, fair enough, 40 years gap, but they narrated after a 40 years gap. Now, if you start looking at the geography, now there are three universities which are claimed to be broken that time or ransacked. Now, she says that Nalanda is the only place which exactly cannot be located. But while someone is coming from Delhi, so there will be a sequence. There will be Nalanda, then Udhampuri will come in the last, and the one more university is there, which is Vikramshila. So that will be the sequence. You will have to first cross the Nalanda, then you will go to the second, and then you will go to the third. So the first university is not named. The first place is rather not named. Then she talks about one of the Tibetan monks who comes in, right? And she uses him as a defense that if Nalanda was destroyed, then why, how did he come over here? But that guy himself writes in the Tibetan text that Nalanda was not too full of its glory, how it existed. And thus we are talking about Truske. They used to call Truskas, the Turks were called something like that. The Turks were still raiding the place. The continuous raiding was still happening. So certainly the place was not at peace, and there was a continual raid by the Islamic invaders that was ongoing. See, again, it's very ironical that she talks about the fatwas of farmans of Aurangzeb and then says that, you know, though he may have ordered, but maybe that these many temples may not have been demolished. But for this, again, we need to go back to where these guys to come from. So many people do call these people Mughals, but they're actually not Mughals. I don't know how many of you are aware about it. They call themselves Timurids all the time. They have been abusing Mughals left and right. When you read their biographies, whether it's Babarnama or it's the work of Humayun, they are just not very happy with the Mughals. Mughals are the people who do come from the lineage of Chinggis Khan, and those who come from the lineage of Timur, they call themselves Timurids. So Chinggis Khan is in a fifth lineage of a common ancestor of all of them, that is Tunamai Khan, and the tenth lineage is Timur. So it's like this: Chinggis Khan, Timur over here, and there is one. Now Timur has made himself too different from the Mughals. He is a highly Persianized person who is too much into learning the Persian. So now this also gives you a reason that why Mughals were so much into, or Timurids rather, to be very honest and clear, was too much into Persian than any other language. Now, Timur's biographer Yazdi, the person who wrote his biography, he says that Timur's ultimate aim was to spread Islam, demolish the structure. He is stating it outrightly. Three fathers visited the court of Akbar in 1580. They are the Portuguese, they are some European fathers. They visit the court of Akbar and they say that the mazars have appeared over the demolished Hindu temple. So they are making this observation. So how come Audrey Truske is saying that, you know, nothing like that would have happened? So this was very much in nature of the civilization, or rather the society by which they were coming from. In fact, when you read the text in a document of Babur himself, while he was entering Kabul, so he has a lot of opposition from a lot of tribes. They are not letting him in. So he's in similar habit of making the tombs of the skulls, and he's again talking about the idolaters. And there's a part in the book where you have mentioned that Audrey Truske is translating it in some much, much more different way than Jaduna Sarkar has translated. What is very interesting, and actually there was a point which was raised that why we should not reread Persian and learn Persian, rather we should learn our language. But I do take the word of Jadunath Sarkar. Jadunath Sarkar had said to his pupils, he wrote a letter, or rather he had given an address while he was retiring. And he said that, you know, you need to know the language of the authorities. So here my, because Mughal history is something of my interest, so language of the authority was certainly Persian. I took the thing to learn Persian. So I learned Persian and I have gone through that text. And there the word exclusively uses kafir. That's the word, quote, kafir, unquote. So kafir doesn't be translated as how Eaton has done or how Audrey has done. It certainly means the people who are not Muslim, as simple as that. So there is no amount of doubt which can say that the Aurangzeb has any intention to protect any temples, or he had, because if you start reading his fatwas, he even goes on to talk about just putting a ban onto the Hindu celebration. There's a long list of the bans what he has also spoken about. So how can we expect that he will not do even, and come on, Audrey is trying to play a victim card of being a female and whatnot. But we all remember back in 2021, a NASA intern was mocked just because she put a Lakshmi goddess by the side of a computer. So we have seen all kinds of things. So perhaps we should not buy, certainly we should not buy these kind of arguments given by the people who are not very clear how to read the primary sources. Thank you. And it's really a nice work. Thank you.